We are. This is supposed to be the Chassam Sofer on the Haggadah. Now, the truth is, there is a Sefer out there that's called the Chassam Sofer on the Haggadah, but I didn't use it. I haven't used it yet. What I use are different, the other Sfarim of the Chassam Sofer, meaning I looked up stuff on Pesachim. There's a Chassam Sofer on Chumash. There's the Toras Moshe on Chumash. There's a Sefer that has from the Drushes of the Chassam Sofer based on the different parts that are around there. So first, a little bit about the Chassam Sofer, the reason why I chose this over everything else. I'm related to Rabbi Akiva Eiger. I'm seventh generation. Mother's 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 father's mother's father's mother is Rabbi Akiva Eiger's daughter. So because of that, I have a connection to the Chassam Sofer, but it's not through that. The Chassam Sofer's second wife was Rabbi Akiva Eiger's daughter's second marriage. He had three daughters. One of them was married to the Chassam Sofer after the time around. The Chassam Sofer grew up as known as being a prodigy, a massive, massive genius. He was the student of two people, Rav Nassen Adler, when he was really young, when he was 12 years old. He didn't even go home for his bar mitzvah. He was by the Rav Nassen Adler for quite a while, and then he learned by Rav Pinchas Horowitz the Hafla. He learned from both of them, and he really took from both sides. Hafla was a little bit more Hasidish, Rav Nassen Adler was a little bit more Kabbalistic, but both of them had a true Derech and Ian. And the truth is that if there's anybody else to emulate when it comes to learning a Sugya B'Ian, it would be someone like the Chassam Sofer, and the way that he writes in Shas, it's very like, it takes just from the following. Really, he does this in Chumash as well. You want to learn a Chassam Sofer, you have to know the following. In order to do it in Chumash, you have to know Rashi Ramban really well. And then you can see the Chassam Sofer, because 95% of the time the Chassam Sofer is coming off of Rashi or the Ramban and adding to it, although he gives his own Chidushim, obviously, but it's almost always based off of the Rashi or the Ramban. Barely ever have I seen him, and I've been through the Chassam Sofer Al Torah and Toras Moshe, I don't think I've really seen him quote other Rishonim. There are, but he doesn't really do that. And in Shas, it's that way as well. He's obviously learning Rashi, Tosos, Rush, and Ramban. And the Rashba when the Rashba is necessary. But that's it. He really doesn't use other Rishonim. He'll quote a Ritva once in a while, but I love the Chassam Sofer, and I've seen it so many times. I don't often see him quoting it. He really has that derech that goes through, that takes the Iker Rishonim, and then pulls out something for you that goes through there. So I feel like when it comes to the Haggadah, there's something that, obviously, we're talking about a Tanoic piece of work. You want to call it a Brisa? You can technically call it a Brisa. We're dealing with one of the later Tanoim, probably second to last generation or last generation of the Tanoim, maybe first generation of Marim that put it together. Now, granted, it could have been pieced together at different times and added to and subtracted and whatever it is. It could be that that's the way it went, but the likelihood is that it was put together by one Tan at one point, taking different Mishnahs and Brises from different places, and we come out with what we call the Haggadah itself. And what he does is he gives you, obviously, these tremendous chops that are out there, but simply put, just reading the simple part of the text, which is, you know, really the derech that I've grown up in, being in Beis Yisrael and the Mir Yeshiva, it just helped me really understand it that way. So let's do the first one. The Chassam Sofer says, why we eat karpas? What's the point of karpas itself? And the obvious answer that he gives is, when they were slaves to Paro and Mitzrayim, most of the food they ate were vegetables of the field, like melons and gourds and things like that. And we see that later on, the Chassam Sofer says, because the Pasuk says, they said, they forgot, they were worried later on. They said, where are the melons and the gourds and all the other types of vegetables that we're eating before? Where are those things? It's like, we haven't eaten any of that stuff since we've been in the Midbar. Sure, the mun is awesome and it tastes like anything, but we missed the vegetables. We missed those because that's what they ate in Mitzrayim. They couldn't afford meat. They couldn't eat the meat or chicken or things that they had. So instead, they ended up having their staple was vegetables. And the reason why we have this in the beginning of the Seder is to remind us that we're slaves, and I know the dichotomy of the fact that we're leaning with Haguffin in the beginning, so we're already showing that we're free, but the concept of being slaves, eating the broken piece of bread in Yachatz, and starting off with Halach Ma'anya, and going into Avadim Ayinu, etc., the idea is that we're slaves, so the point of Karpas is what they used to eat, and obviously the tears, the Ksav Sofer says this, the Chassam Sofer's son, Reb Avram Sofer, who took over for him after he passed away in Pressburg, in the city of Pressburg, as the Rosh Shiva and the Rav of the city, the Ksav Sofer says, he, by the way, was the Rebbe of Reb Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. So if anybody knows The Guardian of Jerusalem, that book from art school was the greatest book of all time. It's in my top two of the greatest books of all time. That's The Guardian of Jerusalem was referring to Reb Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. He uses a Talmud of the Ksav Sofer. He says, because the vegetables were dipped in their own tears. They were so obviously, like, gone from what they were doing. It took them a lot out of them to be able to go. Says the Chassam Sofer, when you go through later on, you notice that there's two dippings that you do on this night. Two of them. You're supposed to dip by the karpas into the salt water, and then the maror into charoses. Now, it's a little bit different by the maror and the charoses. You dip it, and then you're supposed to wipe it off. And korech really is part of that. So it's not really three dippings. It's really two dips that you're supposed to do. But the truth is that it really takes a little bit of work to understand what does that mean exactly? Why do we have to dip twice? And what does it mean? We say, that we do twice. It's interesting, right? There is a sefer written out there, I forgot if it's the Or Kos Chaim, that says that you should not dip anything else during the meal into anything. Sure. Because there's only two dippings on that night. Now, it's wrong because we actually do three dippings because we do karpas, maror, and korech. So we don't do that. But have you ever seen somebody not dip into ketchup, instead pour the ketchup on top? Not dipping into barbecue sauce, rather pouring the barbecue sauce on top? I've never seen it before, but that is a minhag based on one of the early achronim because of this, because we only have two dippings on this night. So he says the Chasam Sofer, because there's two times things are dipped in the Torah. The first thing that's dipped is Yosef's coat was dipped into the goat's blood in order to show it to Yaakov, you know, and to give them what they had. And the second one was dipping the Azov for the Parah Aduma. They took the hyssop together with the Azov, the Shnis Salos, etc., and they dipped it inside together. And then they went ahead and they sprinkled with the Parah Aduma ashes on top of the person. Yeah.
Didn't the blood by the tribe come first?
The blood of Mitzrayim, meaning by what?
They
dipped it inside in order to give it out, but put it on the, yeah, Mishtama, yeah, it would probably be the same idea. Well, I'm sorry?
I don't know if it's in the Torah.
It might not be Vitoval. Yeah, it's possible. Utvaltem? Oh, then it would be. Yeah, then it says the word Utvaltem. Yeah, so he says two, but he does go into the dipping of the Azov, the Parajuma. Maybe he says the same one because it is sort of the same idea. But he says the dipping of Yosef's coat represents Sinas Chinam, the hatred of one man for his brother, right? That's the reason for our galus. And then the way to get back is to have the agudas ezov, to have everything together and have this type of harmony from all different plants together and to go everything together. So we start our geula, we start our seder, dipping into the tears of galus, and then it goes on into the end where we dip the mara into charosis to make it a little bit sweeter to say this is when we're freed. So we start our seder that way and we end it that way for this very reason to be able to get down there. Now, why don't we make a bracha on Magid itself? Magid is a very, very strange thing that we don't have a bracha on that itself. There are about, you know that sefer on Hanukkah that has Ner Lameya, it has like 100 reasons as to why we celebrate 8 days of Hanukkah instead of seven, like the Beis Yosef's Kasha, why we have that. So Ner Lameya has 100 answers altogether. There's a new sefer that's out. Somebody said it had 250 answers to the same Kasha as to why we have 8 days instead of seven. I don't know if like the last like 15 answers are like the same one being worded in different ways. I have absolutely no idea. I would assume it would be. I can't imagine you have that many that goes through. But this question also has at least 50 answers to it. Why don't you make a bracha on Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim? Why don't you make a bracha on that? Lots of great answers for it. The Ran says that the bracha should be spontaneous. Some say that the bracha afterward is going to be that way. The Nesivu says because the bracha at the end includes everything. That's the Nesivus' answer. Rabbi Yaakov Melissa, who lived at the times of the Chasam Sofer, lived around that same time. He says because it was the very end. Although we normally prefer the bracha to be made over Lasi Yasan. What does over Lasi Yasan mean? As we learned in Pesachim, before the actual act happens. So we normally make a bracha beforehand, right? But a ger can't do that. Why can't a ger make a bracha over Lasi Yasan when he's being Megayer himself?
He isn't a Jew yet.
He isn't Jewish. So we can't make the bracha before we start Magid. Why can't we make the bracha before we start Magid? We're not freed yet. We're still slaves. It's a brilliant answer from the Chasam Sofer based on the Nesivos, right? That answer is right there. There's no way to be able to do it over Lasi Yasan. You can't make a bracha beforehand for this simple reason. You can't do it because we don't make the bracha until the very, very end. It's impossible to be able to do so. You can't do it because you're not freed. You're not able to make a bracha on Geula up until that point. Okay, that was that. Let's get into the first part of Magid itself. Again, I don't know how much we're going to be able to do, but at least start. Halach ma'anya, right? The wording is really, really strange. Number one, it's in Aramaic. There's only two parts that I remember in the Seder that are Aramaic. If somebody can remember something else. Halach ma'anya is Aramaic, and the very end of Chad Gadya is Aramaic. Is there anything else? Is there anything else that you can think of that's Aramaic? I don't know if there is. I know those two, the beginning and the end. And there's a famous Rav Shur on why it has to start and end with Aramaic. But this, at least, the Chsam Sofer itself brings down that the reason why it's in Aramaic, and there's so many reasons, right? Because we want people to hear us, we want the Malachim to make sure they don't understand, etc., and all the reasons given. Says the Chsam Sofer, this was written by the first group of Jews who were exiled after the Chorban. This is written at that point. Meaning, we're talking, if this is true, meaning Halach Ma'anya, I don't know about the rest of the Seder, because we already said this was late Tanayim. But Halach Ma'anya was put together by Jews that were exiled right after the Chorban, way before the time. This would have been, give or take, around 300, 350 before the Common Era, right? Sometime when they were in Bavel, they sat down to a Seder when I guess for the first time in a long time, without the Korban Pesach, without being able to be in Yerushalayim, without doing everything, and they remembered everything they did before. So they said, Kol dichvin yesev yechol. Last year, everyone who had a Korban Pesach would come and eat it. They would go and eat whatever they're supposed to do. This year, we have no choice. So kol dichvin yesev yechol, kol dichvin yesev yisach, I should say it like that. Kol dichvin yesev yechol is anyone who wants to come and eat can come and eat. Because last year, kol ditzrich, anybody needed Yesev Yifsach, was able to give the Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach could not be shared with somebody else. If you shechted it for you, and then other people were there, if you didn't have that person in mind, they couldn't eat the Korban Pesach. But this year, we're by ourselves. They said, anybody wants to come and eat can go ahead and eat. And the reason why they did in Aramaic is, simply put, they were in their new land in Bavel. They already had changed their language to the way it was going to be in the future. They wanted to awaken themselves to the sad reality that they were in, that no longer are we freed. No longer are we able to do what we want. We can't bring the Korban Pesach. There's no more Korban Pesach involved. So says the Chsam Sofer, that's the reason why they did specifically this in Aramaic itself. Okay, there's a lot as to what exactly happens with Halach Ma'anya, etc. I don't know if I'm going to mention everything over here, but either way, regardless, the Chsam Sofer says, come eat with us now, because in the future, we're not going to have the opportunity to do tzedakah. That if anybody wants something now, when Mashiach comes, he's not going with the Rambam, which is a rarity for the Chsam Sofer. He usually has everything the Rambam says, but he goes with the Ramban's view of how this works. In the future, there will be no need for tzedakah. Everybody is going to be wealthy. Everybody is going to have what they need. And therefore, kol ditzrich, kol dichvin yesev yechol, anybody's hungry, come and eat now. Let me give you something now because you still can. But in the future, it's going to be almost impossible to be able to do that. It's almost impossible to be able to have it. Now, this is the famous line. If we wouldn't have been saved out of Mitzrayim, after we go through the Manishtan and we say, avadim ayinu lefaro b'Mitzrayim, if we wouldn't have been saved, the wording the Haggadah is, Hare anu anachnu v'tzatzeinu. Well, what is it? And our children, and our children's children, adayin ayinu mishubadim leparo b'Mitzrayim. We'd still be mishubed to paro Mitzrayim. So the question the Chsam Sofer asks, which is a question that everybody asks, is that true? Will we still have been slaves? It's been 3,300 years since then. Would we still be slaves down in Mitzrayim up until the way? At no point would we have been freed. There are no places in the world where slavery has been going on for that long. It's been slavery for years and years and years. But for 3,300 years, we would still be slaves in Mitzrayim. What does that mean? So there's answers, right? The famous, the Vilna Gaon, that we would be meshubed. We'd feel some type of servitude or we'd be ingratiated to Paro for releasing us, right? There's something like that. The Chsam Sofer has an answer and he says, we may have gone out, but we would have lost the sparks of Kedusha that would have stayed in Mitzrayim. When Yosef was gathering all the money together, he says, when Yosef was gathering all the money from all the Egyptians, from all the people all over the place, and they were coming to buy food in Mitzrayim, he wasn't just gathering money. He was gathering sparks of Kedusha, so that everyone, their holiness, would come down to Mitzrayim, and he would, I don't know how, we're talking about tzaddikim, he would place the Kedusha of that person who came in front of him, place it on the coin in his hand. Everything they had, he would stare at the person who came, and this is the reason why they had to line up by Yosef, and everybody handed their coins over to Yosef himself. Of course he had people who could do that for him, but as they would give him the money, he would stare at the person, grab that Kedusha in, put it on the coin, and then flip the coin into the treasury. That treasury that Paro had was filled not just with money, It was filled with Kedusha of all the people of the world. He was gathering the sparks of Kedusha that were lost by the times of Adam Rishon and the Chait that he had done. He gathered it all together, put it on the coins, and literally all of the Kedusha in the world was sitting in Paro's treasury. That's where it was. So when the Jews left Mitzrayim, they had to take money away from the Mitzrayim, because that's where all the Kedusha was. They took not only their own, they took the Tzivos B'nai Yisrael, so to speak, the money. The money was the idea of Kedusha, of the armies of B'nai Yisrael. They took with them when they left. It's interesting. He says the exact same thing when they counted the people and they gave Chatzi Shkalim. In Parsha Shkalim, we read in Parsha Kisisa, it says, the Chassam Sofer says, Moshe and Aaron stood there and counted every single person as they came through the Chatzi Shekel, for the exact same reason. They were able to find the Kedusha of that person, find the Kedusha that person had, and place it on the coin so that the coin could be used for something special, which we all know is eventually used for the Mishkan. So they were able to have something special. So too with the donations in the Mishkan. He goes on and says that the Kedusha is there. If we would have left Mitzrayim then, without anything else, yes, we would be free. We'd be physically free. We'd be able to do whatever we want, but we'd be missing something. We'd be missing all of that Kedusha that we'd never be able to get back because it's stuck in Mitzrayim. It would be impossible for us to go back there. We would have lost it forever. So we would be technically meshubed to Mitzrayim until the times of Mashiach. We'd need to go back and grab that Kedusha at some point, and we wouldn't know how to do so. Says the Chassam Sofer, that's what it means, we'd be Meshubadim, and things like that. He gives another answer, that without the Torah, the world would have been an animalistic world. That if we wouldn't have left, we never would have received the Torah. If we wouldn't have received the Torah, the world would be a world filled with animals that look like human beings. Just animals that live in an animalistic world. Therefore, it's possible, yeah, we'd be slaves in Mitzrayim because nothing would change. It would just be the same world over and over and over again. Over the thousands of years, lions have not changed their disposition in life. Neither have rhinos, neither have elephants. So why would the Jews have changed their disposition? We would be the exact same people living the exact same lives. Yeah. You'd assume that the Torah would have been pushed off or given to somebody else or maybe a small amount of nation, you know, instead of to all of Bnei Yisrael. But you're right. Obviously, if the Torah never would be given, then the world would just be destroyed. We'd be the world number 7 that would have just be destroyed after those first 6 or whatever happened. Okay, then we go into the Maisa, the story with Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Elozman Azari, and Rabbi Akiva, right? Everybody's sitting together in Bnei Brak. And he asks the question that's also famous. Why were they in Bnei Brak? Bnei Brak was the city of Rabbi Akiva. His Rebbeim were there. His Rebbeim wouldn't have gone to him. He would have gone to Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer, his Rebbe. They wouldn't have come to him. Rabbi Elozman Azari was a quasi Nasi at the time. Why would the Nasi have come to him? What happened? So, of course, everybody's heard the answer of Akiva Nechamtanu, that Akiva consoled everyone at the end of Makos, and that they needed to go to him. Says the Chassam Sofer, it's easy. The easiest answer in the world. Haman's children were living in Bnei Brak. Haman's kids were all living in Bnei Brak. This wasn't so long afterward. I mean, it was long, but it was only about 430 years after the Purim story, give or take a couple years here or there, right? But around that time, the children of Haman had a minhag, says the Chassam Sofer, to sit up learning about Yetzias Mitzrayim in Bnei Brak. And there was a tikkun that they did for what Haman tried to do. Haman tried to destroy the Jews, so Haman's kids would go over the miracles of the Jews, including what happened to their great, 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 etc., grandfather, years and years and years ago. They would go over everything in Bnei Brak. So they specifically went to Bnei Brak, says the Chassam Sofer, in order to be metaken everything that Haman did together all as one. So the Tanaim had a minhag to go to Bnei Brak to sit and learn with the Bnei Haman to go over miracle after miracle after miracle to say not just what happened in Yetzias Mitzrayim, but what happened since then and all the miracles the Jews had done. It is a halacha that on the night of Pesach, you go over any personal miracles that might happen to you. If you have a personal miracle, something amazing that happened to you, you should go over those miracles and speak about them in Shulchan Aruch or at some point during Maggid if it's not going to bother everybody else because it's a really long story and it gets annoying. Shulchan Aruch is a perfect time for it. Maybe like afterward when everybody's like sitting there in bed and you're just like, I have a great story, and let them fall asleep at the table so you can be Yotzi going upstairs and they can go to sleep afterward, right? That's a really good time to be able to do it. But you sit there and you say over all these miracles, says the Chassam Sofer, B'nai Haman did that. That's what they did. So everybody joined them and everybody came in. I don't know if it happened every year or if this is the only year that these five Gedolim got together at the same time. But the Chasam Sofer says that's why they were there, right? And he says it was obvious. This is such an obvious answer that they were there. So you felt that way, Zevi, right? Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's the first obvious answer I would have had over there. That's 100%. Okay, after Maisa comes Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, we all know, was 18 years old, but he looked like he was 70. Okay, he was 18 years old, but he looked like he was 70. There's a problem with that, obviously. It sounds strange. We're quoting a Mishnah. It's a Mishnah in Brachos. He's like, I'm 18 years old, right? Harani kiben shivim shana. It's like I'm 70, but I'm not really 70. I'm only 18 years old. And here's what he says. And I never knew, this is what he says, I never knew that you're supposed to Yetzias Mitzrayim at night. It's because you're 18. Isn't that like an obvious answer? If a guy gets up and says, I'm 70 years old and I never knew this halacha. Okay, I hear you. That's crazy. That means it must be such a rare halacha. If a guy got up and said, I'm 18 years old and I never heard that halacha, wouldn't you say that's not that big of a deal? You're only 18? Wouldn't that be the answer you'd give him? I'm sorry? He was a tremendous gon, even at the age of 18. But that's not the reason why I don't know it. He shouldn't have said that. He's been like, I've been through Torah 7 times, and I still didn't know this halacha. The wording of, I am 18, and I don't know this halacha, is like, yeah, I understand that. That would be the reason why you don't know the halacha. Hariani ki ben shivim shana should not be the wording he's using. It should be something like Hariani, very old. Harini Zokin Gadol, right? Or I've learned so much. Something like that. Shalom, what were you going to say?
I don't know. He said, wasn't that should
be said. Fine. At the age of 18, you weren't Zokha. I get that. I'm saying that it's the same idea. The same basic idea. So the Maral in Gebruas Hashem, Simen Nun Gimel, says Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah started going white when he was 18 years old. But he wasn't fully white until he became much older. So he only had like little streaks. Like he woke up in the morning, and the way the Gemara says it, he had streaks of white in his hair. He had little bits of white in his hair, but it's not like he went all white. We might picture like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah got up in the morning after he turned 18 and his 18th birthday, and his wife said like, happy birthday. Oh my gosh, you look totally different. I don't think that's what it is. The Maral says, no, he just had white streaks. So he looked a little bit older, so he looked a little bit different. But the Rambam really explains this in a different way. He says he worked so hard on his Torah learning that he looked much older than he actually was. So he looked like he was 70 because he spent all night every night sitting and learning from the age of, I don't know, I'm guessing, from the age of 7 until 18. So by the time he turned 18, he lived 3 times as many years as he actually was. He looked like he was 70 at the age of 18. So Chasam Sofer asked a question on that Rambam. He says, so that's the reason why, he says, because he was so learned that it was like he was 70 years old. He wasn't really 70, but he was so learned, and he felt like he was 70 years old, and he didn't yet know that Yetzias Mitzrayim happened at night. So the Chasam Sofer asks the Rambam, saying that he looked so old. The Chasam Sofer says, nobody has that happen to them ever. I know a lot of people who worked really, really hard when they were young, says the Chasam Sofer, but they didn't look like they were 70 when they were 18. He said, that's possibly a greater miracle than the miracle that the Rambam's trying to get around.
Literally looking, or he says it.
You felt like?
Yeah.
According to the Gemara, he had the white streaks in his hair. So like it sounds like, you know, the Rambam's trying to say that he looked white because of how hard he learned. But says the Chasam Sofer, no matter what, you've never seen an 18-year-old look that way. There's no way that ever happened. So what was the Rambam trying to do? The Rambam's like, no, that's too big of a miracle for his hair to change overnight. Instead, he just worked really hard and he made himself look old. Says the Chasam Sofer, that's a bigger miracle than what you're trying to get around. I would go with the other miracle. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. So Chasam Sofer says, truth is, all Talmidei Chachamim, if they work really hard in learning, they should automatically look like they're much older than they are. They should look horrible. They should look absolutely horrible. They don't work on themselves, right? They don't work out. They don't eat well, right? They do all these things. They should look like they're 150,000 years old. That's what they should look like. But the problem is, if that happens, then nobody's ever going to want to be a Talmid Chacham. Because everybody's going to look at Talmid Chachamim and say, why do I want to be like that? That guy looks like he's a billion years old. Why would I want to do that? So Hashem makes a miracle for them that they look younger and they're healthy and things look better, even though they should look a lot older. So there's a miracle that Hashem does. So according to the Rambam, all Hashem did was he took away the miracle. he allowed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to look the way he should have looked if there was no miracle. He didn't allow the miracle to occur. He looked a lot older than he actually was. So even at 18, yes, he looked like he was 70 because that's truly what he looked like. That's the idea behind it of how it was. We ended up saying that over there. Then he says something. I don't know if anybody's heard this idea before. This is a crazy idea. I've never heard this before in my life, but I said it before. I told Rabbi Tversky, and Rabbi Tversky just turned 70. I told him that he's not really 70. He's not really 70 because you don't count the first 20 years of your life. 20 years don't count whatsoever, so he's really 50, right? You should be zoche to live, right, to 140, because why not? If you're going to live to 120, 120 starts after the age of 20. Here's what it says over here. The wording is, as you just said, Hariani kiben shivim shana. I'm like I'm 70 years old. He's like he's 70, but not exactly 70. What did he mean by that? In Brachos Chaf Ches, it says he was 18 and his hair looked white because he was much older. Rambam in Perish Mishnayis on that Mishnah, Rambam says that he worked so hard, as we just said, that he looked at older than he actually was. Tosos in Shabbos Nundalit asks, there's an impossibility here. This is a Tosos in Shabbos Nundalit. He asks, how is it possible that he was only 18 years old if he had Meiser Behema? Now, what's Meiser Behema? Meiser Behema is a meiser you take off of all of your animals, right? You bring them through all the newborn animals of that year. You lead them through the corral. You lead them through a little opening. You let all of them count through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And by the 10th one, what do? You take a little thing, a strap. You make it look red, and it has something on its rump. And that's the Meiser Behema. That's the 10th animal right over there. Here's what he says. It's such a chop from what's it called, from the Chassam Sofer. When did you do Meiser Behema? When was Meiser Behema applicable? When was that done? Only during the times of the Beis HaMikdash. You couldn't do Meiser Behema after the Beis HaMikdash was done. Because Meiser Behema, what happens to the animal by Meiser Behema? What do you do with the animal by Meiser Behema? You're supposed to bring it as a korban. But you can't do Meiser Behema afterward. But the Gemara says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah gave Meiser Behema all the time. He had whatever the wording is. There were like thousands and thousands of animals as Meiser Behema. How he says, if Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was 18 at the time that all of this happened, he's saying, I didn't know, etc. He said, when was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah alive? Again, Meiser Behema could only be during the times of the Beis HaMikdash. If he's only 18, it's impossible. So he says like this. He says the following. He says, we know in Tehillim that David HaMelech says, Yimei Shnosenu Behem Shivim Shana. The years that people live is 70 years old. Okay? But there's a problem. Where do we say those words, Yimei Shnosenu Behem Shivim Shana? Where do we say this?
Shabbos.
No. Where do we say it in the Gemara? Not I'm asking on Shabbos. You're right, in Shabbos. Where Tehillim? Which Tehillim is that in? Yimei Shnosenu Behem Shivim Shana, Vim Bigvuros Shmonim Shana. And then there's Rabam, Amol V'Oven, right? It's right in Kigaz, Kishmina Ufa. Well, where do we say it? Where do we say it on Shabbos?
Shabbos.
On Shabbos davening. When? Shabbos morning, right? Oh, this is already good times. Right over here, so we say right over here, we say, Yimei Shnosenu Behem Shivim Shana, where is it? It's right over here, sorry. In Tehillim, Vinoam, right before Vinoam, Yimei Shnosenu Behem Shivim Shana, Vim Bigbro Shmonim Shana, Barama Alvaven. Tehillim Tzadi. Do you know how Tehillim Tzadi starts off? Tefillah, Lamosha, Yishua Elokim. How long did Moshe Rabbeinu live? 120 years. In fact, we don't even really meet Moshe until he's 80, right? Why did Moshe say, in Tfilo la Moshe Yisrael Elokim, Yimei Shnosenu Behem Shivim Shana? Yes, and the Tehillim. I know David HaMelech compiled Tehillim, but one of the compilers that put it together before he went through was Moshe Rabbeinu. So Chassam Sofer asks, how is it possible? Moshe Rabbeinu lived to 120. So he says the following. He says, the year you live to 70 after you already turn 50. After you turn 50. Meaning 70 years plus 50 is altogether what? 120. And if you're really strong, then you can live to 130. There is no reason to only say Ad Me'av Asrim Shana. It all comes from a mistaken pasuk in Bereishis toward the very end, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Noach, I want you to build the Teva 120 years before it goes. And he says, because the days of man will be 120 years. But he's referring to the days of man before the Mabul. He's not referring to the years of people after that, because how long did Noah live? 950 years. He wasn't living to 120. Shame lived for another 600. Like, the people that were born after that did not live. How long did Avram live for? 175. How long did Yitzchak live for? 180. How long did Yaakov live for? 147. It's not like anybody lived to 120.
What about Moshe?
So what is that? Moshe lived to 120. So as time went on, it went lower and lower and lower. I get that as time went on. But 120 is not a limit to how long you can live.
I live
123. Yeah, 123. Miriam lived right then. She lived to 126. Right? You have Sarah Bas Asher, who was like 7 billion years old. You know, she was like from the beginning of, I don't even know when, right? We had people that were living for a tremendous amount of time. So he says the following. He says, the normal amount of years of a person is 70 years old after you have 50. Now, why 50? Why do you live to 50? How long does it take to understand your Rebbe?
40 years.
40 years, right? You start learning at when? Ben Eser Lamishnah, he says. You start learning Mishnayos. I guess Chumash is somewhat easy, right? So you start Ben Eser Lamishnah. So you start learning at the age of 10. Then you have 40 years where you have to understand your Rebbe. So you get to the age of 50. 50 is like an automatic. And then you get to add on 70 years to that. So 70 years is added on to that, right? That's the idea behind it. But 50 is automatic. 50 is automatic. Now you're getting what's happening.
The same Mishnah calls Shonim Gurus.
Gvuros Shana, right.
No, but the Mishnah Pergavos is called Shonim Gurus, no?
Oh, Gvuros, meaning going Ben Esther LaMishnah, Ben whatever it is. Yeah, that's still fine. It's meaning the Mishnah might not be based on this Pasuk or might be going in a different shot.
He's based on the one.
Yeah, on the one thing, on the 10 over there. That's okay. I'm still okay with that. I'm still okay with that, yeah. That's okay. I'm okay with that. I'm totally okay with that. But listen to this. Now do you get it? If 50 years is automatic, then when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, I'm 18 years old, he never meant he was 18 years old.
He was 68.
Hareni kibben shivim shana. I'm almost 70. That's what he was saying. Now what he's saying is, I'm almost 70 years old. I've had 50 years of learning. I've added another 18. And that's that. And that means he was really 68 years old, which means he was alive during the Chorban. Right? He was alive when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, which means he did give Meister Behema, right? And therefore, at the age of 68, what he was embarrassed about is not that he looked so young. It's that he didn't have any white hair yet. He looked really good for a 68-year-old. He was a 68-year-old with jet black hair. So when his wife turned to him and said, you're going to be the Rosh Hashiva, you look like you're 30. You look like you're 30. To which he said, HaKadosh Baruch can do anything. And that night, he ended up having white hair. He ended up getting his white hair that night, and therefore he looked as old as he really was. That's the Chiddush of the Chasam Sofer, which is brilliant, but we all know that Tosus and Shabbos Nun Dalet. So I think we all could have come up with that shot and added on the 50 years that are automatically there for everybody and do that for everybody. But again, so most of us, I'm not 50 yet, most of us have not lived yet. We haven't even started living. We haven't even started yet. Our 18 years starts after we hit 50. Once you hit 50, that's when you start living, and that's when you become, that when everything is totally different. It's an absolutely unbelievable idea.
How does that reconcile with Drakeva, where it says,
that's what Rabbi Sheinfeld just said on that Mishnah. I'm going to go with, I would assume Mr. Morgenstern's line that I am not going to bother with it. That's probably what I'm going to do. Yeah. When you have a Chassam Sofer like that, I'm just going to go with that. I'm perfectly fine. Yes?
You're saying that Moshe Rabbeinu was 80, when Moshe Rabbeinu said that line,
Yeah, so you're saying, I don't know how old he was. He could have been 80, could have been 120. I don't know whatever it was, but when he said, you live 70 years after your first 50. That's what he meant. And if you want to live to 130, you can live to 130. That way you don't have a Shiloh from like, you look in the Guinness Book of World Records and the longest person to have lived is like 123. You don't have to be like, Sheker v'kozov, right? You don't have to say that. Like, it's true. You can live over 120. It's not like a big problem. It's not like you see a person who's over 120 and be like, liar, they're lying. It's not. You could. There's like that one guy who claims to be 140 or something like that. He probably is lying. But regardless, so you don't have to say he might not be. It's possible that it could be four there. That should be over there as well. So what's so bad about Lachem? By the Russia, we say, Ma avoda zos lachem, right? What is this avoda for you? So the truth is, it's a weird word because lachem is not a bad word at all. The Chacham himself says, Ma edus v'chukim mishpatim asher tziv Hashem Elokeinu eschem, right? He says the word eschem as well. So you have lachem by the Russia, what is God commanding you? And then you have eschem by the Chacham in which he's commanding you. Yeah.
To anyone, you never use
You say they?
Now, you get around it. I'm just saying.
You say it like that. It's gender neutral. Gender neutral. That's what it has to be.
No, no. You're accusing someone.
You're accusing. You thought like this. You said like that.
You.
Very good. Very good. So why is Eschem okay then?
What?
By the Chacham. Ma idus vachugim shol asher tziva Hashem
lekeinu Eschem. The word you, I'm just saying.
The Chacham also didn't write emails. He didn't write emails though. Right, no, no, so he didn't write emails either. That would be...
It's not the subject.
Yeah, it's a little bit different, right? So there is the famous answer. I don't remember where I heard this originally. It's just obvious that the Chacham cares about the past, the present, and the future. So the Aleph and the Suf and the Chaf Mem in the middle. He cares about the past, that's the Aleph. The future is the Suf and the Chaf Mem in the middle. Lachem are all letters in the middle. Chaf, Lamed, and Mem are all in the middle, so they're all, he only cares about the present. He could care less. The Russia doesn't care about the past. He doesn't care about the future. He just cares about the here and now. What does this help me right now? But he doesn't care that there was a past. He doesn't care about what's going to be in the future. That's that. The Chassam Sofer says, the word Lachem is Shabbos Hi Lachem. He's asking, he doesn't understand why this physical idea can be used for Kedusha. The problem of any Russia is that they say, the Gashmias is my Gashmias. My Ruchnias is my Ruchnias. You can't mix the two. There's no way to make Gashmias into Ruchnias. It's impossible. That's the problem that the Russia has. And to that we say to him, it's not true. You can raise something to another level. You can bring the Gashmias into a higher level over here. And the truth is, this is Esav's claim. Esav's claim to Yaakov is, how can you use all this stuff for Ruchnias? You can't have four wives and 12 children. That's not for you. That's for me. I should have 100 wives and all these kids. But Jews shouldn't have this. To which Yaakovino said, if I raise it up in Ruchnias, if I raise it up to another level, then I am allowed to have this type of idea. And it took a while. I mean, Yaakovino didn't get married till the age of 84, right? So it took a while to build himself up Ruchnias-wise to have four wives and all the kids, etc., and to deal with the Gashmias of this world, right? But 84... difficult.
So
really
Lachem,
difficult.
The
kids think
his father, how come you have all this wealth?
The Shabbos Hilachem, the physicality of you're supposed to have all your riches on the table and the best foods and all the fatty, etc. How could you do that? This is like totally against what we're into. How could you do that? All right, I'm gonna go with the last sums over here. I don't think I'm gonna be able to finish. We'll just do this one over here. Some great ones on the Chad Gadya, but I got a bunch of problems, and I'm not going to say all of them right now, but simply put, Makas Bechoros, right? Killed all the Bechoros, right? And we all know it as in the middle of the night, which is Chatzos Alayla, HaKadosh Baruch Hu went through and destroyed every Bechor throughout all of Mitzrayim, and that was that. Paro was a Bechor, right? He didn't die at Chatzos Alayla. So why is he running in pajamas in the middle of the night, running up to every door, but everybody died already? The Bechors are all dead.
They died already?
They died at Chatzos
Alayla. Hold on. Went over the whole
in Pashup Shot, he Kasi Kol Bechor Eretz Yisrael means I killed every Bechor in Eretz Yisrael. I killed all of them, right? They all died at Chatzos. So Paro is like running around saying, don't let me die, don't let me die. You're not dead. This should have been right there. Remember what happened by Dever? One Jew's animal died during Dever. And he's like, see, the Jews are also having that. And here, like the Bechors all died and he's alive. He's alive. Shouldn't that be the biggest proof that Makas Bechoros didn't happen? Shouldn't he have gone up and said the exact same line that he did by Dever? It doesn't really count. It's over here as well. It didn't really happen. I'm alive. I'm 100% alive. If his daughter was the firstborn, she also didn't die. Bissy also didn't die. That's also another strange thing altogether. That's number one. What's that? And what's he worried about? What is he worried about? He's not dead. So they're in Smachos. Mesechus Smachos is the back of Gemara Avodah Zarah. At the very, very end of it, there's like those Mesechtos Ketanos that no one ever does because they're weird. But at the Smachos is one of them. It's an awesome Mesechto. Before Smachos even starts, there's like an introduction to Smachos. There's like a five-line introduction. It's literally not even part of the Gemara or whatever you want to call it, Mesechta Ketana. It's like a little tiny introduction. And over there it says that in the middle of the night, HaKadosh Baruch Hu hit them. He Kasi means he hit them. The Nafsham Mefarcheses. And their souls were, I don't know how you want to put it, like, you know how like the lizard's tail like moves around, that word is used over there. Like they were all sick and dying. That's I think what you're referring to, Zevi. They were dying until the morning. So this is also brought down by the Chizkuni, the Paneach Raza, and the Rabbeinu Ephraim. They stayed alive all night long. They were hit at midnight by HaKadosh Baruch Hu and killed by the Malach HaMaves over the night. That's why the Jews weren't allowed to leave until morning, because the Malachim Avos is in the streets. What is the Malachim Avos doing there? God is killing everybody. The answer is no. God said he was going to hit the Mitzrayim. He did it. God hit the Mitzrayim at Chatzos. But the death, v'meis kol b'chor, they're going to die. The death happened through the Malachim Avos. That's what it says over there. The Chassam Sofer was where I saw this originally. The Chassam Sofer points out that thing in Smachos and says that's what it was. He ran through, Paro ran through Mitzrayim because he was also hit at midnight. He was hit. And he was dying. He was really, really sick and dying, running through the streets, begging the Jews to allow him to live before the Malachim Avos met up with him. If the Malachim Avos would have met Paro first, and obviously Hashem didn't want it that way, but if the Malachim Avos would have met Paro first, he would have died before he would have seen that and he would have been gone. But he didn't. He somehow got to Moshe Rabbeinu beforehand, before he got to the Mashkas, and Hashem and Moshe Rabbeinu allowed him to be the only Mitzri, Bechor, to live. And he knew, because he went through all of Mitzrayim, he's the only one who didn't end up dying. He says the most obvious reason in the world. Why wasn't it that Hashem killed the Mitzrayim himself? Hashem said, I want to do it. Ani v'lo malach, ani v'lo sarf, ani v'lo ashliach, right? Why wouldn't he kill them? Says the Chassam Sofer, he can hit them, but he can't kill them. Why? If God kills you, you know what that's called? Mises Neshika. That's what the greatest tzaddikim gets. You'd love to be an Egyptian that night. You'd be sitting there saying, like, please, I could use this. Like, let me have this death. It's been really hard 9.5 makos. You know what I'm saying? Like, let me just take in the Mises Neshika. I'll take a little kiss on the cheek. If that's my death, I'm perfectly fine with it. What happened was, is exactly this. There's a cherev that Hashem has, the sword that we mentioned, Zua Cherev. That sword, which is the Malachim Avos, in some way, shape, or form, is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed to do. It's that it didn't happen through God directly. It happened, so to speak, through the back of God, through the Hester Panim of God, so that Hashem hit and then allowed them to be killed by something else, so it wouldn't be Mises Neshika, until they finally died that morning through the Mashkas himself. That shame, the Magen Avraham mentions it in Siman Tuf Ayin Gimel. There is a sword of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is known as Yud Vav Hei Chaf. You can pronounce it because it's not a real word, Yuhach, right? Yud Vav Hei Chaf. Yud Vav Hei Chaf. He says that's the reason why we dip 16 times in the Seder. This is what the Magen Avraham brings. It's not like, you know, Magen Avraham says the reason why we dip 16 times in the Seder, Dam Va'esh V'Sim Rosh Hashan Ditzach Adash Be'achav and the 10 Makos, says the Magen Avraham, because you have Yud Vav, 16, Hach. That's the hit that he had over there. And Shalos V'Tshuvas Yoradea Shin Mem Vav, the Chassam Sofer says, based on that Magen Avraham, there is no way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually killed him. Rather, at Chatzos, he destroyed the Mazel Tleh, that Mazel that's up there, and he weakened all the Bechoros so that they became whatever, and therefore they died by the morning itself, by what ended up happening that morning itself. But Paro ended up having everything happen in some other way altogether. You should know, by the way, that shame of Yuhach is hinted to everywhere. The Vilna Gaon, when he used to say goodbye to people after they would leave him, he would say the words, Yachav Verabim Halacha Karabim. Everybody always thought, oh, the girl is just saying like a cute Mishnah, you know, to leave them on a Dvar Halacha. But he wasn't saying that, because the shame of Yuhach is supposed to be the shame that saves you when you're in the middle of your travels. So, Yachid Virabim Halacha Kirabim, the first letters are Yud Vav Hei Chav. So he used to say that to them on purpose. Rechaim Volozhin said that in his Biurei Rechaim Volozhin al Agra. Right? He said that's the reason why. We say it in our davening. If you're davening normally, and I know art school doesn't have this because it's art school, so they have like certain things but not others. But over here, you say, Al Pnei Ho Adama in Berech Aleinu, Al Pnei Ho Adama v'sabenu mituvecha. On the bottom it says mituva. So what is it? Is it mituva or mituvecha? So the Tamina Hagen brings that if you're davening normally, if you're in a normal state and everything's all good, you should say Pnei Ho Adama v'sabenu mituva. Because the last letters are Yud, then a Hey, then a Vav, then a Hey. So you should say v'sabenu mituva because it's normal. But if you're traveling, if you're on a trip somewhere, then you should say the word mituvecha, because then it becomes Yud, Hey, Vav, and Chaf. And then you have the shame of Yuhach, and that's what you're supposed to say over there. So you say that line right over there. In fact, we even know it from Vayetze, Parsha Vayetze. There's another, like, three Ramazim to this, but Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Charana, right? Yaakov left Be'er Sheva, and he went to Charan, right? He went to Charan, Vayelech Charana. You didn't have to say that. You could just say, you don't have to say the word Vayelech. You could just say, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Lecharan. You could just say that. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Lecharan, because he went to Charan, right? Well, if you take the words Vayelech Charana and you just do Licharan instead, the extra letters in Vayelech Charana are Vav, Yud, Chaf, and Hey, because of Yud, Vav, Hey, Chaf. so that when he traveled, he had the shame of Yuach on him, so that he would be protected wherever he went. So that shame is everywhere. It's all over the place. You're going to find it like in weird places now, and you're going to be like, nah, and it's going to be like, yeah. But if the Magen Avraham brings it down, and the Chassam Sofer says that was the reason for this, that's there. So we'll stop at this for right now, everybody, but the Chassam Sofer is just amazing, and there's so much more over here. This is just the beginning of everything that he says on the Haggadah itself. Have a great rest of the week.